Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One. In fact, as one of our listeners recently indicated, also the podcast that is always on the mark. Thank you to Wallace in Austin for that. My friend, it is a long weekend. I know, my friend, you have been grinding this year. You have been putting in the hours, both at your main job, your side gigs, the family. Are you going to get some rest this weekend? What are your plans?
Oh, yeah. This weekend, I'm just going to kick back and relax. Like you said, it's been crazy busy the last couple of months. I mean, it's Easter weekend. Happy Easter to everybody in advance who's celebrating. Happy Vaisakhi to all my Sikh friends out there. We were celebrating today at the office, so I am full of all wonderful Indian foods, and it's been a great day. Now we get to sit down and talk Formula One, so I can't think of the perfect nightcap. Well, you know, besides the fact that I got to sit down and edit all this audio afterwards, but for the rest, it's been a pretty awesome day. But how have you been,
my friend? I've been great, and it's not that you have one podcast to edit tonight. You have two, because earlier this week, we've recorded an interview with Tyler Senarusa, who is the owner, the founder, the mastermind behind Sensport Graphics, the company that produces a lot of the Formula One helmets, a lot of the IndyCar helmets that you see in those championships. So that was a great conversation. And because there isn't a Grand Prix this weekend, we're planning to drop that podcast Sunday. So most people would have it ready to go in their stream Monday morning.
Yep. That's right.
Yeah, and that should be good. And we've got a couple of other exciting ones lined up. We still have an upcoming interview with Lily Herman of Engine Failure, amongst many other pieces. And as we teased a couple of days ago on the Twitter feed, we have an upcoming interview with Megan. I almost said it. We have an upcoming interview with a W Series driver who has in fact won a W Series race, but I don't mean to give it away. So I'm going to keep teasing that one, but that one should come out in a couple of weeks. All of that said, you know, it's been a relatively quiet news week in the world of Formula One, but we still have some really great stories to get to today.
Oh, totally. And I should say for everybody that's listening right now, totally check out Mark's conversation with Tyler. I've already had a sneak preview. I've listened to it. It was really, really cool. Well done. And I'm sure everybody will enjoy that. And I was, you know, not to give too much away, but I can't believe that was Tyler's first ever interview.
I completely agree.
I was really kind of shocked about that. My mind is blown when you look at his work and, you know, go to his website. I mean, his helmet art is just mind-blowingly awesome. I mean, he is a very, very talented artist.
My favorite takeaway from the interview, and I obviously this would never even cross my mind, but when he was painting the helmet or preparing to paint a helmet for one of the current Formula One drivers, one of the requirements was you can't use more than 40 grams of paint and clear coat on the helmet, because if it's any greater than that, the weight multiplies in a high G-force corner, it multiplies exponentially, wow, and it causes serious harm to the driver's neck and muscles. So they have strict tolerance is even with the amount of paint that they can use to execute the vision of the driver or the rider, which I thought was fascinating. Again, giving away too much, but definitely check that out next week.
Yeah, there were some mind-blowing things that came out of that conversation, especially like that 40 grams of paint. I mean, that's not a lot to work with. Yet he can still do this amazing work. Okay, well, why don't we get into what we have lined up for some of the news stories tonight? And it's been a sort of kind of busy, but not too busy week in the world of Formula One news. So it's expected that Formula One is going to return to South Africa, to Kyalami, to have a Grand Prix there. They haven't raced there in almost 30 years, not since 1993. So it's really kind of crazy to think that it's been that long. I mean, I don't even remember that race. I mean, obviously, it's going back a long time, but still. I mean, we've seen some other historic tracks come back onto the calendar, Zandvoort being one.
Great call.
Back to Holland last year for the first time since 1984. Imola is back. I mean, we're going to be there next week for for what is it now, the third year? Because yeah, they came in the first year of COVID.
Yeah, this will be year three.
Yeah, year three, and that's been a fun one. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not there's any fire associated with this smoke, but certainly fun to see. Anyways, Stefano Domenicali, the F1 CEO, said he has a real desire to add a Grand Prix on the African continent. When you think about it, I mean, there is a pretty glaring omission.
Absolutely.
When you look at the population, yeah, in Africa,
absolutely.
The size of the continent that they're, you know, it, you know, when you look at all the pins on the global map, that there's obviously a big gap there. And Domenicali had to say, quote, on top of America, on top of China, I think there is a potential also to be in Africa soon. There's a lot of interest there. For sure, that's another area that is so far missing in the geography of our calendar, end quote. Anything you want to add to this one?
I'm actually very excited about the potential return to Kyalami. And I, to be honest, didn't know a lot about the current state of the track. And I did a little bit of half-assed mm-hmm. internet research today. It turns out it was purchased in the last, in the last recent history. It was significantly overhauled, new grandstands, new garages. It is not FIA grade one. It is FIA grade two, but it sounds like with some fairly easy investment, they could get it to FIA grade two. And it's understood that most of the changes that would need to be made would simply be additional runoff area for the safety of the drivers, as well as tech pro barriers, as opposed to some of the more concrete and steel barriers that they have there today. Took a look at some simulations of cars on track. It looks like a fantastic track. Even though it's almost 5 kilometers, it's reasonably compact. There's tons of elevation. It's very, very, very fun. I'm excited. And for those of you that don't know, and you alluded to it, we haven't been there in almost 30 years. The last time we were there was 1993. Alain Prost won for Williams. The year before, Nigel Mansell won for Williams. But prior to that, there was a 7-year gap, because if you go back to 1985, the 1985 South African Grand Prix was fraught with controversy because the global community was outraged at the fact that South Africa was imposing this horrible, lawful, state-inflicted form of segregation on almost half the population, or more than half the population. And at that point, the global community effectively had enough, and they started boycotting sporting events with the South African teams. And in 1985, there was a great amount of controversy about whether this Grand Prix should ever go ahead. And Bernie Ecclestone, being Bernie, insisted it went ahead. But a number of teams, including two of the French teams, didn't participate because their own governments prohibited them from going. But it's an entirely new track. I think the continent, as you described, should absolutely be hosting a Grand Prix. And if they can make this work financially, I would love to see it. And if you haven't, go and check out some of the track sims and some of the track footage on YouTube, because it looks like a really cool track. It looks like it's a lot of fun, and it's in a beautifully scenic area. So I'm very, very excited about this. But it just goes back to what you and I were talking about over the last few weeks, which is we keep adding tracks, right? Like China's coming back next year. We're going back to Shanghai. We're adding Las Vegas next year. We've got Singapore coming back online this year, Australia back online, Canada back online, possibly now Kyalami. How are they going to fit when we are constrained to 24 races because of the Concorde Agreement? It's possibly, and you are a bigger advocate, and I know that Tim Horaney is a bigger advocate of this, is taking certain less profitable events and making them alternate. So maybe they're only on the calendar every second or every third year, and then you'll have kind of core, richer events that are maybe on the calendar every single year. But it'll be interesting to see. But I would be very excited. To me, this track reminds me of a combination of Mugello and Portugal. It looks cool.
Mm. You know, it's funny you should say that, because when we were saying that there's tons of like elevation change, I was just, that was Portimao was the first one that sort of popped into my mind. I know that we're not there this year, but the past 2 years, and I know it's maybe not 100% suited to modern Formula One cars, but I couldn't help find myself enjoying it. I thought it was, from a spectator's point of view, it was a fun track to watch, because you have some fairly tight, compact tracks, corners, a lot of elevation change, some dips and some rolling hills. I thought it worked really, really well. Lewis Hamilton did have a couple of things to say about potential to go back to South Africa. This is a quote, and it reads a little bit funny. It sounds almost a little bit flippant, and I don't think Lewis is that way in any stretch of the imagination. So just, you know, take it with a pinch of salt. I don't want to sort of quote him out of context, but he does have a good take on it. Anyways, Lewis had to say, quote, "The one I really want to see is South Africa. That's the one I want to hear announced next. We're pretty much on every other continent, so why not? Ultimately, my ancestors are from there, so that's why it's important for me personally. I think it's important for the sport to go there. If we're there in every other continent, why not? End quote. I mean, he basically said the same thing we did in that last sentence.
Agreed.
They're everywhere else, why not? So hopefully they can pull something together. So it's funny, over the last couple of years, whenever you've seen one of these sorts of stories kind of like pop up into the news feed, it's, well, I mean, apart maybe from the whole VW group saga that kind of, you talk about a slow burn.
Totally.
That's like, you know, open up the dictionary, or, you know, people still use traditional paper dictionaries. But anyways, look up the dictionary, the definition of slow burn. It'll have like a picture of like the VW group. Anyways, I was just going to say that whenever you see one of these stories pop up in the news feed, it seems sooner rather than later that there is some sort of an announcement regarding Grand Prix. So we're going to sort of kick it up into Homer mode here. Well, maybe not, but we're going to talk about Nicholas Latifi. The Williams driver admits that he's had a real difficult start to his season this year. And, well, he totally has. I mean, you got to give props to his teammate Alex Albon, that the whole, what was it, tire whisperer joke that's kind of been going on the last couple of days. I mean, some brilliant tactics for him to score a point last weekend in Australia, but Nicky's season really has gotten off to a really, really difficult start. So why don't you take it away?
So first of all, you know me far too well when you preface this story by saying we're going into Homer mode. This story may or may not have been inserted into the agenda because it's a Canadian driver in Nicholas Latifi.
Early in the agenda.
Right at the top. Oh my gosh. I think my concern for Nicky is I feel like racing, and I've competed at some very, very, very amateur levels, is incredible. It's very physical, it's very technical, but it's also incredibly mental. And if you are not absolutely dialed in and brimming with confidence, the likelihood that you're going to make a mistake is amplified exponentially. And I worry for Nicky that after the outcome in Abu Dhabi, the duel crashes in Jeddah, and now, of course, the incident with Lance, even though that was not his fault by any means, I worry about the mental space that he's in. And I hope that with this 2-week break, he can find a little bit of space and come back dialed in. Mm-hmm. But it should also be fairly inspirational for him to see what Alex Albon's been able to do with that car, because obviously they brought Albon in because they wanted to have a benchmark, or they wanted somebody that had some Formula One experience. But so far, Alex has been just crushing Latifi in practice and qualifying. And again, Latifi had some bad luck in winter testing and he missed a big chunk and he didn't get to put in the same amount of laps, but he's getting crushed by Alex, and he's got to start cutting down that delta immediately if he has any hopes of keeping the seat for 2023 and beyond. And of course, we like him because he's a great guy. He's a Canadian kid. You couldn't ask for a nicer person on the grid, but he's got to start dialing it back in. And if there was anything that you could say about him the last couple of years, it was that he was pretty consistent, and he's not a guy that was prone to crashing. Mm-hmm. And of course, that seems to be the burden that he bears now because of some incidents in recent Grand Prix. But mentally, I'm really worried about him. But I feel good knowing that due to Albon's exceptional performance at that last Grand Prix, he's shown that maybe there is in fact some pace in that car when it's paired with the right compound. So for Nicky's sake, for Formula One fans across Canada, hopefully he's going to be able to dial it in, cut that deficit to Albon, and start putting in some racy performances.
And definitely. And I just want to read a quote off the official Formula One website, in which Nicky said, quote, "It was great to see Alex finish in P10 in the end, which I also saw at the end, looking at the TV after the checkered flag and saw that he was there. So super happy for the team because it's been a real difficult start to the season. But on my side, there's purely still quite a bit to find. We were just struggling to find the balance and the pace. I think if Alex is able to extract that performance out of it, then there is no reason why me and the other cars shouldn't be able to. So definitely brings confidence, and yeah, for sure going to have a nice time looking through the data, trying to understand how he was able to make it work," end quote. And, you know, let's not forget, Nicky's already been in Formula One for a couple of years. His contract is up at the end of the year. And I don't want to suggest that maybe Williams might think about pulling the plug, but when you look at Alex Albon, which was a complete shock signing last year when he announced them, I don't think that Williams would be too afraid to make a splash when it comes to making a change to their driver lineup. I think that they just, I think they're in a position now with the regime, the management structure that they have now, that they're going to do whatever they think is best for their team. And I think that that Alex Albon was just the first indication of that.
I completely agree. And I think that this is the end of the pay driver era, meaning that 4 or 5 years ago, if you're a team like Sauber or if you're a team like Force India, you may have a budget of $150 or $200 million versus the $300, $500, $700, $800 million that Red Bull and Ferrari and Mercedes were spending. So if you had somebody that could come to your team and maybe they weren't your top choice as a driver from a performance perspective, but they brought $40 or $50 million of funding and sponsorship, you're going to sign those drivers. But the reality now is because there's that $135, $140 million cost cap, the pay driver doesn't bring you any value because you don't need that money to compete with the other teams. Like maybe it's good for your bottom line, but ultimately now what's more valuable is having a driver that's more likely to score you points. So we're at the end of that pay driver era.
Yes.
And I think 100%, I think this team has absolutely flexed their independence, like you said, with the Alex Albon piece. And I would be very surprised if they weren't shopping for a different driver. And again, Nicky still has 20 races. This season is a marathon, and there's plenty of opportunity for him to improve his craft. But I think this team is eager to show improvement, and Dorlton Capital, their new owners, are eager to make an impact in the championship.
You made such a great point there that that teams probably now want to sign drivers that are going to deliver them points and maybe get that money in the form of prize money through the Constructors Championship rather. Yeah, that was the perfect the perfect way to bring it up. And you know, I really loved the boldness that they did, or that, you know, that stand that they took to sign Alex Albon, because it just seemed like it was going to be. And I don't want to throw any shade at Nick DeVries. I think Nick is a great driver. I mean, he's proven it in other levels of motorsport, but it just seemed like it was almost a foregone conclusion. He's a Mercedes driver. Williams is a Mercedes customer team, and he's basically going to be dropped in there, like we've seen other teams, not just Mercedes, but excuse me, any other team that's had like a customer team sort of drop their prospects in there so they can get time in seats, times in races, and things like that. And completely out of the blue, well, I mean, I know there was a little bit of smoke around that fire regarding Alex Albon, but until that was made official, I was a little doubtful that it would happen, but I loved it, and I hope this is going to be maybe a sign of the times. But I guess you could make that argument too, what with the whole Haas situation and Mazepin getting dumped, and then K-Mag coming back on a multi-year deal, that perhaps, like you say, like the driver that comes with the big, you know, sacks of money with dollar signs scribbled on the front doesn't necessarily mean as much as it did
almost
a year ago or 2 years
dog.
ago.
Can I call you dog? Sorry, I'm a little bit relaxed tonight. Sure. On this Thursday night, I was shocked that they signed Alex Albon. Like you said, there was smoke. I'm like, they just do not have the nerve. They are not that independent. And when it happened, it shocked me. And I loved all the reporting that came out at that point, especially around Toto, because of course, Toto, of course, leading Mercedes, which is the company that feeds them their power units, had taken it as a foregone conclusion that they were going to sign a Mercedes driver. And when they didn't, I love the stories about Toto pleading and begging and eagerly trying to get a hold of Jost Capito to try to understand why that was happening. Because not only did they not sign the Mercedes driver, they signed a rival away from Mercedes's chief rival in Red Bull, which made it all the more spicy. So that was fantastic. I love it. And I want to see more of it, because I absolutely despise B teams in Formula One. It infuriates me that Red Bull is allowed to own a B team on the grid that is clearly nothing more than an immediate filter or sister team. I hate the fact that Haas is dependent on Ferrari for parts and funding in the way that they are. It infuriates me that Williams has basically been at the beck and call of Mercedes for the last 7 years. I hate that, because the grid is so small already. It just helps perpetuate this lack of competitive balance, and the fact that you're only going to have three teams because they're feeding power units to these other teams on the grid and they're dictating who their drivers are. And it just doesn't make for a truly 10 deep championship. So I thought it was awesome.
Yeah. Well, that's why I loved it, because, I mean, obviously, I mean, I've said it on the show before, I mean, Williams is a team that I have a soft spot because I cheered for them and their drivers when I was growing up in the 80s and the 90s. I mean, 100%. They were an awesome team. They had such awesome drivers at that time. And just to watch, I mean, the last guy that won a race for them was Crashtor Maldonado way back. Was
Repeat that? Sorry, who was that?
Crashtor Maldonado.
Well done. Well done.
Not Pastor, Crashtor. Yeah, those of you who were around 10 years ago get the joke. Those of you who don't understand the joke about Crashtor Maldonado, go look up his highlight reel. I'm sure there's a blooper reel somewhere on YouTube. But anyways, I just loved it when you could almost see Josca Pitigoya mic drop when that signing was announced. Because it really asserted that, you know, we're not just here to make up the numbers. Yeah, we might not be a competitive team right now, but we're going to try and change that. I mean, ultimately, you know, they got to prove it by doing it on the track. It was a real courageous and bold move. The strategy that they ran with Alex Albon in Australia last week, and it paid off with a point. And we might be sort of like saying, oh yeah, it's only one point, but this is a team that has struggled to score a point or two or three over the course of an entire season over the past couple of years. And I think that is just a huge, huge morale booster for them. First of all, sir, you should unmute yourself because I can see you talking.
All right.
And then you can have your take.
I'm a pro. I know what I'm doing here. I was going to say, when I put together the agenda for tonight's show, I thought it was a little bit light, but we're two topics in and 20 minutes deep. So we should probably take a break before I ramble on with the next topic.
Yeah, perfect. Let's take a quick break to have a quick word from our sponsors, and we'll come back and we'll flip it back to talk about Max's turtle comment about the safety car in Australia last weekend. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
All right, welcome back to the podcast. It is always Up to Speed with Formula One. You're listening to Mark Squared. And yes, we are going to talk about Max's criticism about the turtle safety car last week at the Australian Grand Prix. I guess it's kind of got a dual meaning, because the safety car is an Aston Martin, which is British Racing Green. It was slow, like a turtle, and the same color as a turtle. Anyways, Max had to say afterwards, quote, unbelievable with that car to drive 140 kilometers on the back straight where there was not a damaged car anymore. I don't understand why we have to drive so slow. We have to drive so slowly. We have to investigate for sure. The Mercedes safety car is faster because of the extra aero. The Aston Martin is really slow. It definitely needs more grip because our tires were stone cold, end quote. So afterwards, the FAI have responded and defended, using it, because they have like a rotation between the Aston Martin, which is a safety car sometimes, and then the usual Mercedes, which has been the safety car for what, 20, 25 years now, and in various different models. Anyways, they said that the safety of everybody on the track is the priority rather than the speed of the car as a whole. And they said, furthermore, to that point, it is race control that dictates the speed of the safety car anyways. I mean, I'm sure an Aston Martin can hit more than 140 kilometers, especially on a racetrack in closed conditions.
Absolutely. I thought the story was cute and funny, and then I felt a little bit bad for Aston because you look at their Formula One adventures this year, which is crash after crash after crash, and the absolute horrendous luck they've had. And then you have the reigning champion slandering on their otherwise gorgeous, gorgeous safety car. That car, that is pinup material. Print that out and hang it on my wall. That car is beautiful, and I love the Kotler. It just pops.
Agreed.
But for the reigning champion to slander your car, which is also, by the way, their flagship road car model, to slander it as a turtle must have caused some serious, hopefully temporary damage to the valuation of their company. Aside from that, like you said, ultimately, it's not the driver of the safety car that dictates the pace. It's race control. And no safety car will ever go the speed necessary to satisfy the drivers. Because like you said, they want to keep the heat in the tires at 140, 170, 180 kilometers around a track. That's never going to happen. They're not going to be satisfied. And we have heard Lewis constantly, and I say Lewis because he gets a lot of the radio time on the broadcast, but Lewis criticizing the speed of safety cars has been just a common element of every broadcast for the last 7 or 8 years, even when they were Mercedes. So, you know, it's a cute story. It's fun. We can move on.
Yeah, you know who else echoes your sentiments or your recollection? There's Michelle G in the live chat, and she said, when do they not complain about the safety car speed? I mean, it's constant. And it's almost a little bit unfair to kind of like point out Lewis, but just Lewis being the prominent guy that he is and the fact that he is 7-time world champion, he does get the lion's share of the airtime when it comes to the radio. I mean, maybe not so much this year, but I mean, historically, he's had a disproportionate amount of time in the race radio and the broadcast.
Maybe
always makes it sound like, and they cherry pick.
Oh, of course. And of course, they're not always live either. They cherry pick them and place them at convenient moments. Maybe the only other thing I would add as well, and this is, it's related, but not related. The other thing that the drivers are learning to adjust to this year is in the pits, they can't turn up the tire blankets to the temperatures they were able to turn them up to in previous seasons. So in the past, the hot tires were scorching hot when they went on the car, and the drivers could get up to optimum operating temp they could get into the optimum, it's very difficult to say this, they could get into the optimum operating zone much more quickly. Now they're going out with much colder tires, so they actually have to work those tires for a couple of laps to get them up to speed. So incidentally, what we saw last year in the finale in Abu Dhabi, when Max came in for fresh tires and went out with scorching hot, ready to go tires, it might be a different outcome this year if the same circumstances were to play out, because while he's coming in for fresh tires, they're not going to be in the optimum operating zone like they would have been last year because the tire blankets aren't as hot.
You know, I don't actually hate the idea of like, turning down the temperatures.
You need to convince me on this
blankets
one.
Or getting rid of them, because in this day and age, okay, sure, they've taken away a lot of driver aids and things that they had in the past, you know, like traction control, active suspension, et cetera, right? I mean, they still have a lot of things that they can do in the car. And I didn't like it at first when they weren't allowed to coach them over the radio, but I've come to really like that. These drivers are supposed to be the best in the world, right? So give them, there's got to be technology in Formula One. It is the peak of, or the pinnacle of motorsports on the planet, right? So there's got to be that level of technology in the cars to begin with. But I would like to see the drivers have to work for it as well. I mean, it's not just about the car. It's the combination of driver, their talent of being the best, supposedly the best 20 drivers on the planet, driving the best cars on the planet. So if you take away the things like the tire warmers and they have to take that time to warm those tires up and make them manage the tires. I mean, again, I know I've already, shown love to Alex Albon twice. Now this is thrice.
The trilogy.
I'm showing the trilogy there. It'll probably happen again to Alex Albon for the great job he did managing those tires last week in Australia. I'd love to hear stories like that. And it shouldn't be undoable for guys like Charles Leclerc and Lewis Hamilton and Max Verstappen. They're supposedly like the best of the best of the best, right? So it adds another element of unpredictability into the racing. And personally, I like it.
You may have convinced me, actually. So I'm a big fan of every technological aid and advancement possible in F1. I want to see it all. But you're right in the sense that tire blankets are a huge, huge driver aid. And without them, or with a tire blanket that's operating at a lower temperature, when that driver gets back on track, they need to do significant work for the next succession of laps to get those tires into an operating temperature zone where they can really start pushing that car. Yeah, that's an interesting point. You may have convinced me. Now, the only flip side to this is if it's a potential safety risk, that if you're putting these drivers out on cold tires and there's a potential safety hazard or safety risk associated with doing so, then maybe you need to talk a little bit more about keeping them. But obviously the FIA, Liberty, and the teams have agreed to reducing the effectiveness of them. So maybe they found a balance here, but I would hate to see them go. But at the same time, you're absolutely right that if we want to see more of the drivers driving the cars and exhibiting racecraft, taking away the tire warmers forces them to do that. It's one more skill they need to develop and exhibit every race.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, I wouldn't want to see it completely removed if it becomes like a safety issue. But if, like you say, they found like that happy medium to turning it down, the heat that those blankets can put into those tires to warm them up and preheat them before they go onto the car, onto the track, and the drivers have to work a little bit harder, I think that's a great trade-off. And it just goes to show that, it gives the opportunities these drivers to showcase their talents, right? And I know it's not easy, but then again, isn't the point of Formula One not to be easy? I mean, I'm kind of quoting or using the same sentiment of Bernie Ecclestone as probably the last person I want to be in agreement with. But, that's kind of the point of Formula One. If it's too easy, then what's the point? You know, you got to be good to be there. Anyways, let's move on to the next one. And this is a story we touched on, I guess, within the last couple of weeks. I guess it was maybe 2 weeks ago. We talked about a bunch of the circuits that are coming up to the end of their contracts at the end of this year, and just where most of the tracks are in the lifespan, or where they sit in the term of their contracts with Formula One. And Monaco, like I said, it's up at the end of this year, but the organizers said that they believe that it will retain a spot on the Formula One calendar beyond this year. And, you know, it's having a race in their own backyard. How many of those drivers live in Formula One? It's become almost synonymous with them. I mean, they made that movie in the 60s, Grand Prix at Monaco, using the drivers and the cars of the time. It's, you know, Formula One and Monaco, the glitz and the glamour kind of go together. It's not the greatest track. It doesn't really demonstrate. I mean, some of the, I guess I shouldn't say it doesn't demonstrate what the cars are capable of when you see these guys flying around literally millimeters away from the barrier. So it's technically a very demanding track, but it can be quite boring at times. I mean, we've heard the drivers really lash out in recent years that, you know, there's no opportunity to pass. And I think it was even Fernando and Lewis were saying, what was it, in 2017 or thereabouts, that it was just the most boring race that they'd ever been in, you know. So anyways, my point is, I just struggle to see a Formula One that would walk away. And I just can't see a Formula One that doesn't have a Monaco Grand Prix in it. As a fan, either love it or hate it, I think it's going to be there for the long term.
Yeah.
I just can't see it going.
I agree with you. I think Formula One, maybe for the first time it's in its history, because of course Monaco's been around since 1950. I think maybe for the first time in its history, Formula One could survive without Monaco on the calendar. And I think 10 years ago, I would probably be dragged out in the street and beat up for making a comment like that. That would be so controversial, because it was so important to the championship when you had 16 or 17 Grand Prix and Monaco was a staple. You're right. The cars have outgrown the track. They outgrew the track many, many, many years ago. I don't think it's going anywhere, but I do think it's interesting that right now, like you just alluded to, the Monaco race organizers are negotiating with Liberty for a new 3, 4, 5 year contract. Well, that's interesting, because prior to Liberty taking over the sport, Monaco paid nothing to host a Grand Prix. They got it for free. That's how important it was to the calendar. And not only did they get the race for free, they also had the ability to execute the TV broadcast. So they actually used their own crews, their own cameras. They cut it. The race direction was all there. So they had total creative control over the event. I only hope now that if Monaco is paying for this event and they've got to be able to turn a profit like every other Grand Prix, hopefully they'll continue to invest in the track. Now, all of that said, I agree. I don't necessarily get excited to see this one because it can be a bit of a procession unless there's a string of safety cars and crashes that make the race a little bit more unpredictable. We've seen some fun races there, and qualifying is always exciting, and it's exciting because it often dictates the outcome of the championship itself. But I would be okay if it was gone, but like you said, I don't think it's going anywhere. I just think that for the first time, Liberty has an awful lot of leverage given how many places are chomping at the bit to host a Grand Prix, and they can now squeeze the race organizers in Monaco to get as much money out of them as possible to continue this championship. Now, all of that said, I'll quickly add this. I was reading a Reddit thread about this earlier today, and I was really down on the Monaco Grand Prix, and I read a couple of comments from people that had actually been fortunate enough to attend it. And they said, yeah, you know, I get it. The race isn't great, but when you head into the city on the train and you step out of the train and you walk through the tight, narrow corridors, and then the track opens up in front of you and you can hear the howl of the cars bouncing off of the canyons and the buildings and the tunnels there, it's a sensation and this experience like nothing else on earth. It's not something that you and I will ever be able to experience, and it doesn't necessarily translate well onto TV. So it's not going anywhere, like you said.
Oh man, you know, when you just mentioned like the howl of the engine on the streets and everything, like I just checked my Apple Watch here, my heart rate just went up by about 20 BPM. So yeah, you know what, where my motivation is. But you know, I wouldn't say a love-hate relationship with it. I mean, I'm not that down on the circuit. You know, I do enjoy it, but it's just when I look at the other tracks on the circuit, or pardon me, the other tracks on the calendar, there's others that I would pick ahead of it that I enjoy. And, you know, I look forward to each and every year, and there's a couple, Monaco among them. Hungary is another one that you just know you're not going to see a lot of overtaking. I mean, remember back about 3, 4, or 5 years ago, whatever it was it Vettel who won in Hungary? He had that issue with the power steering. He just managed to keep himself in front of Kimi Raikkonen, who basically ran, you know, interference for himself and the two Mercedes cars behind him. And I think by the time that Lewis and Bottas got past Kimi, they couldn't do anything to catch up and pass Seb. I think it was, unless I've completely gone into some bizarro universe. But that's another one of those tracks. And, you know, funnily enough, the Hungaroring, when they designed that track way back in the 80s, was supposed to be a little bit... what do you want to call it? It was modeled after Monaco. So when it came to, you know, the layout of the track, obviously it's not as compact as it is in Monte Carlo, but they certainly nailed it when it came to the lack of passing opportunities. Because I mean, in Hungary, where do you really see opportunities to pass? It really is at the end of the first straightaway into turn one. And then going into, I guess, turn three, I guess it is, turn three and four, when you go into those series of left-handers. Anyways, where did Mark, for the second week in a row, has seemed to have disappeared on me. Here he is. He's come back again. Here we go. My friend, that's 2 weeks in a row that you've dropped off on the connection here. All good. We kept it going. You know, I only said a couple of negative things about you, but it's all good. I was just,
don't fuel the live chat. Don't fuel the chat. Don't get everybody going on the anti-Mark. I just say, well, that would be both of us, but the excited Mark, the anti-Mark H feed. So yeah, and I apologize that.
Don't worry.
I'm an incredibly proud Apple user, but I've been having some system issues with my Apple recently that creates reboots. In this case, I was able to recover it quickly, but yeah, I apologize for that.
All good, all good. Anyways, why don't we go on to the next story here? And where did I put my notes? Oh, I know what I wanted to talk about, because this is kind of an interesting one. I wanted to get your take on this one, because we'll go into the last couple of stories after we have the next break in 4 or 5 minutes, whenever it is. But I want to get your take on this. And I was thinking specifically when it comes to the race, I thought specifically when you were talking about Monaco and how they're able to use their own TV crews, do their own production and stuff like that. I can't help but start getting a little bit irritated, especially last weekend in Australia. And it's not just Australia. I mean, there's been other examples this year and at other times. When I hate the fact when you have on the cars, you have these forward and backward looking car cameras. And then I hate, and I don't mind when they go from in-car to the trackside cameras when it comes to overtakes. I just wish that when it comes to overtaking that they would stick to the trackside cameras. I can't remember which overtake it was last weekend, but they tried to get really cute with the production, have the rear-facing camera and right. then go to the front-facing camera and then switch to the other car. And they completely buggered it up and they missed the whole overtake. And then 15 seconds later, they're trying to go to the, they're showing the replay of the trackside camera. You know, I get it. If you could pull it off, it's really cool. But I just want to see, is Lewis making that overtake stick? Is Charles able to keep Max behind him or whatever the case may be? I just think that, okay, yeah, it's cool if you can pull it off, but just go with the safe option so everybody watching that isn't in the car or right at that part of the track can see what's happening and see whether or not the driver can pull the move off or not.
If you're in Canada and you're watching the broadcast on TSN, does it matter? Because there's probably a commercial taking up 2/3 of the screen anyways. Oh, there goes any chance of us ever getting to work with Bell Media. Okay.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, I know. It always seems quite convenient whenever the commercials come up during the pit stops and things.
For
like
those
that.
Of you Having watching said, in the US yeah. on ESPN, enjoy your ad-free broadcast while you can, or you'll be quickly subscribing to F1 TV Pro.
Well, that was something I had to get used to after I was living in Europe and I came back home, started living in Canada again was right. when I was living in Holland. I don't know what channel it's broadcast on now, but back in the day, it was an RTL television and it was great because you just had, from green light to checkered flag, you didn't have any interruptions. It was just all racing all the time and I loved it. And then coming back and over the years, we've seen, Formula One on different platforms, different networks in North America. I mean, Speed Channel did it for a while. They did a great job. And then TSN's had the rights for a while. But it's always the commercials. But I guess in a sense, we've always been used to commercials in North America. Yeah. It's just when it comes to other sports, like baseball, basketball, the football especially works very well with television just because you're playing from scrimmage. The ball is snapped 5 or 10 seconds later, the play is over. And then it's just easy because you have these natural pauses in play. I mean, hockey and basketball are pretty, intense sports. So they kind of have to schedule it in when there's stoppages in play, but still those stoppages occur. The thing with motor racing is unless there's a red flag, nothing, there's no natural pause in the race. So you have to do something. And it just seems, and that was always my biggest complaint is how come the commercials always right. come during right. the pit stops, or is it just, coincidence, or are they just that good? Anyways, we're not that good. So that's why we don't do this for a living. And because we don't do this for a living, we have to pay some bills. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back on the flip side, we're going to talk about some other things, which I'm not sure of because I lost my notes. Anyways, time to regroup and back in a moment. Don't go away.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right. Welcome back to the show. And well, this is a story and I like where this one is going. So Formula E has introduced their own post-race cool down room. And this is a Reddit thread that you found. And I really like those. I don't know why that they did away with them. I don't know if it was to do with COVID. I don't know if it was due to the TV production, but I kind of liked it. I know at some times in the past, depending which race it was and what happened and who was stepping on the top step of the podium and who came second and third, third. I know there was a bit of tension there, but I always really liked it. I thought it was a cool thing. I'd love to see Formula One bring it back.
Daly, that was the best part. If you're a TV broadcaster and you want me to stick around the podium celebration, which I never do, bring back the cool down room. The amount of drama and friction inside the cool down room was amazing because you've got three guys that just spent 90 minutes battling toe to toe for a race win. And now they're all shoved in the same room. Some of my favorite moments from the last 10 years were the cool down room. My favorite was 2015 in Texas at COTA. Lewis, Nico battling back and forth. They touch. They go into the cool down room. They're both on the podium. Hamilton picks up the Pirelli hat that they're all supposed to wear onto the podium. He tosses it over to Nico. Nico whips it back and it bounces off Lewis. Like, I love the drama. I love the friction. Bring back the cool down room. COVID aside, it's worth it because, like I said, one, it's super entertaining. I love the drama. And two, it keeps me sticking around because I'll be honest, like as soon as the fourth or fifth driver passes the finish line, the start stop line, I'm tuned out. I'm gone. If there's a cool down room, I'm sticking around for another 10 or 15 minutes. Broadcasters, that's great feedback. Take it, bring back the cool down room.
Yeah, totally. I have nothing further to add to that. If anything, they should, like, I don't know, make it super hot in there. Turn up the
oh, yeah.
So it's almost unbearable. Yeah. You know, just, I know that's kind of mean, but you know, try and make it as contentious as possible.
Is it mean if it's hilarious? Because it's pretty hilarious.
Yeah, no, I love that one. When you brought that up, that image just flashed in my head of Nico and Lewis and the whole thing. It seemed so petty and childish, but at the time it was
when
it
happened,
watch, right?
I was rolling on the floor, just cackling, just screaming.
Oh, same.
Because it was, and that was even before 2016 when the relationship really hit the burner, but I was just squealing. We need more of that in Formula One. They can't all be besties all the time.
Well, I mean, that kind of goes back to last year. I mean, there's got to be obviously some frostiness between Max and Lewis nowadays, right?
Yes,
I mean,
put them in a cool down room.
I mean, there's history now, right? But I mean, just nowadays, I mean, Max and Charles like seem a little bit too friendly. I mean, they it was great to see after Saudi at the end of the race. I mean, they're kind of applauding each other, giving each other a thumbs up out of the side of the cockpit. I mean, it was a great battle at the end of that race. And the way that one turned out, but you know, all it takes is a little bit of on track, you know, confrontation to change that. I mean, we've seen that before. I mean, Lewis and Nico Rosberg were great friends growing up, and then that's, you know, obviously they're not sending each other Christmas cards or what people do anymore. Yeah. I mean, that relationship sadly went south, but I mean, you get two guys, especially in the same team, competing at a level like Formula One, there's obviously going to be a tension. And boy, does that still blow my mind going back to, well, that's even probably pre-2016. Do you remember, was it Nicky or Toto coming out and saying at that point that they wouldn't hesitate to void one or both of those drivers' contracts if it was in the best interest of the team? I mean, was that even as early as 2015? I think it was. It might have been after Spa.
I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah. So anyways, yeah, nothing like the good old cool down room to inflame tensions. Anyways, let's talk about another race. We already talked about Monaco. So this is kind of like Monaco, but in the Far East. And this is Singapore, which is coming back online this year after a 3-year absence, obviously been canceled a couple of times because of the pandemic. So apparently this thing, to say that these things are selling like hotcakes is an understatement, but they're really just, the people are going bananas to try and get their hands on tickets to get to the Singapore Grand Prix later this year. Why don't you take this one away, Mr. H?
We had this conversation with Tim Harini a couple of weeks ago, and he was making the point that if you, and I don't think what he was trying to say is if you starve a market of Formula One, but if you don't go every single year, when you do go, there could be monumental and significantly more demand for tickets than there would be if you went every single year. And I think what we're seeing in the case of Singapore is we haven't been there in 2019. They were supposed to be on the calendar last year. It got canceled at the last moment. So we're going back this year for the first time since 19. The demand for tickets is exponential. They've been releasing them slowly. They've been drip releasing ticket packages, and they've been selling out almost instantaneously. Now, they haven't opened all of the tickets, all of the grandstands for sale yet. Like I said, they're kind of dripping them out to the market. But what they've discovered is there is massive, massive demand for tickets on the reseller networks. So resellers are having a heyday reselling tickets for the Singapore Grand Prix. It probably makes sense because I think there's probably a lot of folks in Australia that like to fly up for that Grand Prix. And we just saw, and we didn't talk about this, but Australia posted 440,000 people through the gates over the 3 day, which was a record for the Australian Grand Prix. Yep. It broke the number that Austin posted last year, which is significant. But the other consideration too is Singapore used to have a neighbor race in Malaysia until a few years ago. So obviously there's pent up demand throughout Malaysia for this race as well. Now, what is being rumored, and Joe Sayward reported on this a couple of days ago, I think reporting is probably being a little bit generous, but speculated about, is due to the high demand and due to the fact that the calendar still has an opening because of the Russian Grand Prix, and due to the global logistic challenge or logistical challenges moving companies and shipping companies are having right now, reliably moving freight around the world, that Formula One might opt to put back-to-back races into Singapore. So rather than going to Turkey or Portimao or back to Bahrain or any of those other tracks that we've seen over the course of the last couple of years, they may simply do back-to-back races in Singapore. Demand for the tickets is there. You could probably sell out a couple of weekends. You relieve some of the pressure on the Grand Prix that's already on the calendar. And then you don't have to deal with the freight challenges of shipping the entire circus halfway across the world to accommodate the fact that the Russian Grand Prix is not going to be on the calendar. So possibly we're not going to be in Turkey this year. We may not be in Portimao. We probably won't be in Mugello. But what we're probably going to see is back-to-back races in Singapore. And that's also good for the drivers. It's good for the mechanics. It's good for the teams, because in the middle of a 23 race calendar, from them to be able to park themselves into a single city for a week and a half, rather than having to transfer halfway around the world after 4 days, is probably a good thing. So I think good news all around that if they can do two races in Singapore, they're both a sellout and it takes a little bit of strain off the teams and the drivers. Maybe that's a good news story.
I can't help but wonder why there isn't any talk about maybe going back to Malaysia, because even during the pandemic, I don't know if it was a sort of a planted news story to kind of like gauge interest, but they've been off the calendar now for a couple of years, even pre-pandemic. But I think that there was some talk within the last year, 18 months, that they'd be willing to step up and they wanted to have a Grand Prix again there. I mean, geographically, it is in the same region, but I haven't heard anything coming back or sort of coming out recently about perhaps having a race there. So who knows? I mean, it would work, though. I mean, we've seen over the past couple of years, because of the pandemic, we've seen multiple races go back-to-back weekends at different tracks. In Austria at Silverstone,
right?
We've seen like the other thing where we've gone back to Sakhir a couple of times, at different times,
right?
At the beginning of the season, back of the season, and then with a different configuration, which they can do in Bahrain because they do have the inner and outer ring there. So, excuse me, there is possibilities to do that, but Singapore, they could probably pull off a doubleheader there. What do you think?
Yeah, I would really, yeah. So I think Singapore is going to work, but now you've got me thinking about Malaysia. And for those of you that maybe kind of new to Formula One, have kind of been watching only the last couple of years, we raced in Malaysia at a track called Sepang up until the end of 2017. It's a great track. It was a lot of fun, but it was a race that was organized principally by the local and state government. And ultimately, I think they just exited themselves from the business because they were funding both a MotoGP race, which was exceptionally well attended and much cheaper to host. And they were also funding a Formula One race, which was well attended, but exponentially more expensive. And MotoGP and sport bike culture in Malaysia is huge. So the government had made the decision that, look, we can only subsidize, we can only underwrite one of these two events. We're going to do MotoGP. I think they would have been open to hosting a race. And I think what we saw the last couple of years is a lot of the races that were being thrown onto the calendar, Portimao, Turkey, etc., they weren't paying anything for these events because there were no fans in the stands. In this case, I think Formula One's like, yeah, you can have a race, but we want our $25 or $30 or $35 million. And I think for that reason, we'll probably see Singapore.
You know what's interesting too about like Singapore and some of the stories that have been going out about like the tickets for this year's race popping up on some of these reselling sites? There was one story I read about a woman from Australia that was trying to buy tickets, and she was thrown into like a 3.5 hour like wait list online, and then only after 3.5 hours to get an error message to say that, you know, either the site had crashed or the sale had closed. And then, you know, eventually she goes back to buy a pair of tickets for $3,500, you know, after the fact, you know, $3,500, wow. I think US, I'm not sure exactly. I mean, I know the dollars are used around the world, but I mean, $3,500 for the tickets that were similar to ones that she wanted. But I mean, that's the thing, that pair of tickets this lady might've bought now for, you know, $3,500. I mean, as you know, the rest of the tickets sell out, because like you say, they've been releasing them in blocks, and there's going to be more tickets coming over the days and weeks ahead, where, you know, once those, all those tickets are gone and that, you know, that demand is there, I mean, those prices for people that, you know, then selling them through reselling sites, I mean, those prices are just going to get exponential. I mean, it's crazy where it could go. But I mean, it also shows not only are people eager to see it back in Singapore, people are eager to watch Formula One again, but basically after almost 2 years of being, you know, locked up in our houses, people are just, you know, itching to get out and do things again. And especially, I mean, Formula One did so well during the pandemic. I mean, that we were up and running again by July of 2020, and Drive to Survive really, you know, captivated people's imaginations after, you know, between 20 and 21. You got like a whole new generation of people coming in at the beginning of last year. You have this epic season, this epic fight between Lewis and Max for the entirety of the season. And now as things come back online, we go back more to normal again. People are like, I've been only watching Formula One on my screen. Formula One's coming to somewhere reasonably close to me, or it's a destination I want to go to, and people are willing to put the money out and go to it. It's amazing. It's exciting. Although I just don't know if I'd be willing or able to part with $3,500
right.
set of tickets. Then again, I'm not in the market to go to the Super Bowl either, so maybe I should just... anyways, let's talk about happier things. Okay, this is not really a happier thing, but I guess we have to. this is definitely not, because this really depends on, you know, this is something that we've been, you know, talking about literally now for years, and that is the Miami Grand Prix, which is, you know, set to get going just weeks from now. And boy, you know, there is a last ditch attempt to block this race. So this is going to court. So this is being you know, done by local residents, which, to be fair, they've been very vocal about right from day one. You know, they've had a lot of concerns about the noise and all the disruptions around Hard Rock Stadium in Miami. They say that the noise is going to be intolerable. So they've basically launched a lawsuit. I don't know how, you know, if this is a Hail Mary, how much of a chance that this has to succeed. But, you know, there's obviously got to be a little bit of concern there. What do you think?
It's interesting, because Formula One has had a long and winding road to landing in Miami. And if you remember 4 or 5 years ago, the expectation was that this race was going to happen downtown on the waterfront over a causeway.
Yep.
And then there was immediate opposition from all the residents that live in that area, in the condo towers, and from the businesses that would have been impacted by the disruption of shutting down the course for weeks to set up and tear down for a Formula One Grand Prix. And ultimately, Stephen Ross, who was the one that was going to lead that race, decided that, hey, I've got this NFL stadium up in northeast or northwest Miami, and it's got a huge parking lot. I'll just build a track here. And when that was announced, I started doing my typical creepy thing, which is going Street View to check out the area. And the first thing that I realized was there is a very significant bedroom community of single family detached homes less than a mile from sections of this track. And I thought that was really interesting. And at one point, city council seemed to be generally aligned with the residents of this community called Miami Gardens, and were certainly in opposition to this race happening for those reasons, on humanitarian grounds, in essence. And in 2020, there was an election and a new city council came in, and the new city council voted for the track. And they've been very clear that, look, no no lawsuit is going to derail our efforts to bring Formula One to this track. And if local residents are concerned, they need to take their concerns up in the next election. But it looks like this is going to happen. Now, the actual final permit hasn't been issued, but there's every expectation that it will. But due to the fact that that permit hasn't been issued, it actually adds some timing sensitivity and complications to the lawsuit that's being issued. But I would expect to see this race going forward, but I am still very shocked that in a modern developed country, a racetrack could pop up so close to local residents. And again, you know, these folks, they made the choice to live in that neighborhood, and they live in that neighborhood knowing that there's a football stadium nearby, and that 8 nights a year, there's going to be an NFL game and there's going to be some congestion and noise. But none of these folks knew they were buying a home next to a Formula One racetrack. And yeah, I think it's a little bit interesting that there is so little opposition to this happening. And I get it. Miami is a destination city. It's a service sector city. It's a tourism city. And events like this are what drive and fuel the economy. But it is interesting that they were able to build a Formula One track so close to a residential neighborhood and a predominantly Black residential neighborhood. Now, when the race was approved, when the city approved the race originally, the race organizers indicated that they would make a $5 million community benefits package available. And I'm not necessarily sure how that's being spent. Maybe it's education in schools about STEM and engineering and Formula One, et cetera. But it'll be interesting to see how this plays out in the days ahead. I would expect that the race is still going to happen, but it'll be interesting to see if this opposition stays strong in the years ahead, or if in the future a city council that's maybe opposed to this comes in with a heavier hand. But Stephen Ross, the Miami Dolphins, they've invested tens of millions of dollars in building their racetrack, and we're now just weeks away from the Miami Grand Prix.
Oh, could you imagine the countersuit that would be filed by the race organizers if this would block, you know, was blocked? I mean, they would go after the city and everything like that.
Absolutely. You know,
seven ways from Sunday, but it's interesting. Lawyers for the Hard Rock Stadium and City of Miami Garden said that that a judge should not take any steps that could prevent Miami from moving forward with the race before the city decides whether or not to issue a special events permit. And they said it should be up to the city, not the courts, to decide whether the events, you know, the Formula One complies with the city's bylaw for or their noise ordinance, because what they're saying is that the amount of noise that Formula One cars or the race would generate is about 97 decibels, which is the equivalent of standing right next to a chainsaw, which is, you know, pretty loud. And you know, this is going to go on for several days, so you can understand where people's concerns are and why they'd be upset about that. But they were saying that one of the attorneys was saying that they could only see that the residents might have a case if the fact that the race goes ahead, the noise exceeds the maximums that are determined or set out by the city's noise ordinance, and the city fails to enforce it. So, you know, like everything else, when it comes down to like the legal fine points of view, and I don't want to downplay like anybody's concerns, like any of the residents, because we don't live there, you know, so we can only kind of make observations from afar. If they're concerned about it and they got a point about it, I mean, they should by all means be heard.
But absolutely, absolutely.
You know, it just seems at this point in the game, the fact that, you know, so many people have invested so much money to make this thing happen, and who knows? I mean, if this thing was canceled, I mean, not only would you see maybe a counter lawsuit filed, but what about like, say, a class action lawsuit on the behalf of people that book tickets, hotel rooms, travel? I mean, it just has the potential to get really, 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 really nasty. So I hope for the benefit for everybody involved on all sides, they can sort this thing out. Anyways, Mark, why don't we take one final break here? We'll come back and then we're going to jump into the mailbag, which is something we haven't done in a little while. So let's take a little break here. We'll come back and we're just going to chill out. And well, I say chill out, I don't know what the questions are yet, so I should hold my breath. Anyways, time for a quick break. Back in a moment.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
All right, welcome back to the show and going into the final segment now. Oh, no, don't worry, we're not going just yet, but it's all good. Anyways, Mark, you got a lot of questions
via
Twitter today. Yeah, it just, I saw it when you tagged me in the tweet this morning, and this thing really could kind of took on a life of its own. So let's get into it.
So first question, and this is one that... it's a little personal to both of us. It's from our good friend at I've Been Yuki'd. I won't use anyone's real names because I don't want to dox anyone, but at I've Been Yuki'd, would one of you be willing to change your first name to avoid confusion? This is a real issue for me.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting one. Like, I've kind of thought about that. Like, what could we get? Like, a little bit more Formula One, maybe like Max Power or something like that. I know Homer Simpson used that one before. You know, maybe something a little more of a power name, like Trent Steele.
Do you have Max a middle Power. Name? Yeah.
I do.
What is it? I don't even know.
My middle name is John, which is my dad's name. So, you know, yeah.
Okay.
So we could go by middle names.
So it would be the John and William
Don't
show.
Tell me that.
No. As you were winding up to tell me, I'm like, his middle name is going to be William. I just know it. No, mine's William. So it would be John and William. Yeah. But I'm not particularly in love with my name. In fact, one of the really awkward things for me is both of my bosses until recently at work were Mark as well. So there was three of us, which just created immense confusion. So I would typically, people would just call me Hammer or Hammy or something like that. But yeah, I don't think I can legally change my first name, but we'll try to do our best to create some separation on the program.
We could go by like last names, you know, as Michelle said in the live chat,
works.
I go by daily sometimes. We could go by last names. You know, you could be Ham Dog.
I'm cool with Ham Dog.
That's no good.
I'll take it. I'll take a Ham Dog. I'll take a Hammy. I'll take a Hammer. So next question for you. This is from Emmy. I'm going to leave this one with you. Since you did say fun questions... semicolon, underwear and body piercings, how are they going to find them? And this goes back to a story a few weeks ago about the fact that the FIA is going to start cracking down on body jewelry. How are they going to find them? Metal detector or body search for jewelry, but underwear, because again, they have to be wearing FIA sanctioned fireproof underwear. Yep, Commander or Whitey Tighties Check Brigade. So the question to you is, who's going to take on the responsibility and how are they going to make sure that there's no underwear that are not against FIA regulations or body piercings?
Well, I mean, obviously, like nose rings, earrings, eyebrow rings. I guess even in the the chest area,
you can say it. Nipple rings. Kind of you can say rings.
Those might be kind of obvious and kind of like the tights, you know, like layers that they wear underneath those. But I mean, in the nether regions, yeah, I don't know. Some people might want to, but I hope that maybe just go over like the little wand like you get at the airport when you're going.
That's a smart idea. Yeah, that's a smart idea.
Yep.
Here's one that this is perfect timing because we just went over this, but this is from your good friend Gil at Guitar Gil. Also, what's up with the Miami GP not having a permit yet from the city of Miami? And now there's a lawsuit being filed to stop the event. So I think that's okay because we just talked about that one. So hopefully that answered your question.
I share the concern though, totally what, just as we were talking about before the break there and what Gil's echoes in his tweet as well. I mean, I'm concerned about it. I didn't think we'd be literally less than a month out from Miami and we're still have this specter of a lawsuit and no permits issued. It's worrying. Let's hope that this gets sorted out.
Yeah, and again, I hope it's not at the expense of the local residents, and I just hope they don't get steamrolled because I'm sure none of them bought or moved into that neighborhood expecting there to be a Formula One Grand Prix. And I think part of the city permit is that the only event that can be held on the track each year is the F1 Grand Prix. There is precedent for this, right? Like if you look at Laguna Seca in Northern California, that is a tremendous track and it's gone not into entirely disrepair because they still host an Indy race, but that is a track that should be hosting much more prestigious events. But as people have encroached closer and closer onto the track, the local state, the local governments, this county governments have imposed stricter and stricter regulations on how and when that track can operate. It used to host MotoGP, and now it's restricted on the number of days they can have competitive racing and the number of times they can host a competitive race each year. And that's different because Laguna Seca originally was built in the middle of nowhere, a good half hour from any homes. But as the population has encroached on the track, they've imposed restrictions. This one's different because these are pre-existing neighborhoods and there's a track dumped into their backyard.
Yeah, in one case, motorsport is encroaching on the residents and the homeowners. On the other case, it's the other way around. But going back to Laguna Seca, the corkscrew, is that not one of the coolest segments of track anywhere in the world? It's amazing.
Terrifying in person, my friend. Not even to drive it, but just to walk it. It is absolutely terrifying. And it's one of those moments. And I don't think F1 drivers get enough credit because, you know, when you and I are out on the road and we're driving about, we see a corner and we turn into it. F1 drivers don't turn into a corner after they've seen it. They have to turn into the corner in advance of seeing it. So for them, every corner is a blind corner. But the corkscrew, it's not only a blind, sharp corner, but there's a huge drop. So as you're approaching the corner, you're looking into the horizon, and then the track drops away from you, and you have to turn in. Absolutely terrifying. If you get a chance to go back and look at the Indy highlights from last year, Romain Grosjean had some awesome moments in that corner, just banging and grinding as you can only do with an IndyCar. But yeah, one of the greatest corners in motorsports.
Yeah, totally. Going back to the live chat, Michelle says, going back to the whole body piercing thing and the underwear, she said, and I don't know where she gets her intel from, but she said Christian, pardon me, and I assume she means Christian Horner, said that he thinks both his drivers, so Max and Checo, go commando. So is that a little bit TMI? You know,
maybe
I'm gonna file. Yeah, Max and Checo going commando is a little bit TMI. Okay, let's go on to the next one.
So next question for you is from @SurvivorRay08. When will talks start happening for the driver lineup for 2023? Which potential moves are you most excited about?
Well, what do we have, like 10 drivers that are out of contract at the end of this year? I think that the big teams are pretty much all set, but it's just going to be interesting to see who goes where. We know Lando's going to be at McLaren for a couple of years. Ricardo's there for at least another year, we think.
Yeah, we know Charles, both of the Ferrari drivers are lined up.
And the same at, I believe this is the same case for Mercedes. Max is on a long-term deal at Red Bull. Checo is on a one-year deal. But Checo's had a pretty, despite the DNF in Bahrain, which was nothing to do to him, that was completely an equipment failure. I think he's had a very, very solid start to the season. He's doing now what I think everybody who was cheering for Red Bull wanted to see him straight out of the gate this time last year. So I think that if he keeps going the way that he's going, it just seems almost like a little bit of a foregone conclusion that he would get another contract at Red Bull. I could almost see him becoming Valtteri Bottas V2.0 because he's kind of in that funny age now. I mean, he's been in Formula One for over a decade. He's on the wrong side of 30, but he's doing really, really useful things. But, you know, I wouldn't say that the end is right around the corner, but, you know, he might find himself in a Valtteri Bottas kind of situation that, you know, he has a bit of a shelf life there at Red Bull and, you know, very much like Valtteri had at Mercedes. And then, you know, it just sort of makes sense for the team, maybe not so much for Sergio, that just to give him the 1 year deal with an option or something like that and just kind of renew it each and every year. The one driver I'm interested to see who may end up or where he's going to go or stay, I don't know really too much or how many choices he has, is Pierre Gasly. And I think we've kind of tossed this one around at times sort of casually over the past, you know, somewhat recently, but Pierre Gasly, I think he's maturing nicely. I think that the opportunity for him to go to Red Bull a couple of years ago was the right opportunity just at the wrong time in his career. And unfortunately for him, it didn't work out because he gets booted out of there midway through the season in favor of Alex Albon, who comes in, has a great second half of the season. Everybody's saying, should have put Alex Albon into that car right from the beginning. Pierre just wasn't ready for it. And then Alex comes back for a full year with Red Bull and has a total stinker of a season. and then he's gone. And then they signed Checo. I know it's been it's been a bit of a revolving door there. But I think out of all of them, I think that Sergio's one, definitely, if they're going to bring him back, and then Pierre another one. And then just perhaps even a little bit further down the grid, we know that the K-Mag's on a couple-year deal, but, you know, MSE, what's going to happen with Mick Schumacher? I mean, first year in Formula One last year, not a great car, wasn't a great situation. Now he's got an experienced Formula One driver as a teammate. He's got a benchmark. He's got somebody to model himself after. You know, what's his future going to look like in Formula One? So there's lots of questions, you know, and I wouldn't be surprised to see some of these faces go back to the conversation we had right off the top of the show about Nicholas Latifi. He could be very well one of those guys that disappears from Formula One by the end of the season.
The big one, and I've only got one driver to add to your list, the big one for me is Sebastian Vettel. I don't see him coming back with Aston Martin. I don't see why he would necessarily want to. They're clearly in a rebuilding stage, and they're not going to have a competitive car this year, and unlikely will they have a competitive car next year. And if he doesn't come back to Aston Martin, where does he go? I think there's just so many question marks. He's on the wrong side of 30. He's been in the sport since 2007, yep. 2008, maybe.
Oh, he's had a long career in Formula One.
Yeah. I don't know what team would necessarily want to invest in him, and for what purpose would they invest in him? And I think he's a lovely guy. And of course, back when he was winning titles, he was the arch enemy of everyone. He was the evil evil character of Formula One. And obviously his image has softened, and he's kind of been through a period of rejuvenation the last couple of years, ever since he departed Ferrari. And there's definitely been a bit of a intended social media charm campaign there.
Yeah. Let's be fair. I think he had some good moments at Ferrari. I mean, maybe 2018, 2019, that kind of went into a bit of decline, right? But I mean, 2017, 2018, at least the first half of the season, I mean, he was competitive. They were winning races. I mean, he had a legit shot at least until, I would say, the first half of the season in 2018, he was pretty competitive. And then it started going sideways by the time after the summer break, by the time we got to Monza and then Singapore. And then, you know, he started putting his foot wrong, you know, far too often.
Self-sabotage, man.
Perfect word. Perfect word. Self-sabotage is the perfect way to describe it. And but he had his moments, and I could honestly see him just deciding to pack it in and walk away from Formula One at the end of the year. I mean, at this point, what more does he have to prove? I think he would have loved to win that championship for Ferrari. We all know that he was a big fan of Michael Schumacher. Michael was a mentor to him, and he really wanted to achieve some measure of success at the Scuderia like Michael had. I mean, what Michael Schumacher achieved at Ferrari back in the day is iconic. We'll talk about Lewis Hamilton in the same way with what Lewis did as doing at Mercedes and has done during his time in his career with the Mercedes. But Seb, I think, wanted to model that in small part as much as he could, at least win one title with Ferrari. But, you know, sadly, he just couldn't pull it off.
In the live chat, I'm just looking for it now, Evolution Consulting said, and I agree with him, that Seb looks unmotivated. I want to see an angry, frantic Seb. To me, he seems, as an F1 driver this year, last year, he seems too resigned to the situation. I want to see him angry. I want to see him frantic. I want to see him yelling on the radio.
Okay, can I stop you right there? Please. Loaded this into the soundboard, and I don't know why, but check this out. Okay, why is it not playing? You see, I get these things lined up, and then the tech fails on us. But
you're the one that's supposed to be good at the tech, my friend. I'm just here for the good looks.
Hey, I loaded it. I pressed play. Nothing happened. Anyways, it was a radio thing from a couple of years ago. That's really unfortunate that it didn't play properly.
I'm sorry. That must kill you.
Yeah, that's really frustrating. I think it was from Mexico a couple of years ago when I think he was mixing up maybe with Max Verstappen, and it was that time when he was like, bleep this and bleep Charlie, and Charlie can go bleep himself. Remember that?
Oh, I mean, that would have been so good. You got to try it again.
Yeah, I'll try it one more time.
Try one more time, because our listeners deserve that in their Friday morning podcast regime.
No, it's not coming through that way. Let's try one more time, because it is such a good one.
We tried. We tried our best.
I'm sorry, guys.
Before we jump to the next question, did you want to take a break?
Sure.
Or
no, we're all good. We paid all the bills. This is our time now. This is kicking back and just chillaxing and having having some enjoyable conversation and answering questions.
As you say that,
several thousand of our closest friends.
As you say that, the repo man in his tow truck has stopped looking longingly at the Bentley in your driveway and is now driving away without anything hooked to his car. Okay, next question for you. So a couple of people actually asked this question, but again, at I've Been You, Keith, based on your last podcast, and boy, did we get slandered for our podcast with Tim because of this topic. Based on your last podcast, why do you hate Carlos Sainz so much? Why do you hate him, Mark? Why?
Because he's just so good. No, you know, it's funny because, I mean, we're not trying to throw shade or hate Carlos. And I mean, and I think Carlos is a great driver. Like I've watched him over the last several years to see where he could go, because I really felt at one point there that he might have been really on the cusp of his Formula One career, sort of like flaming out, and there might not be a spot for him in the sport. But then, you know, ultimately it worked out. He ended up at Ferrari. I mean, he ended up in McLaren, and then he leveled up from there and went to race for Ferrari, which is the biggest team in all of motorsport. I mean, no disrespect to anyone else, including Mercedes, but I mean, that is like the team. I think every driver wants to race for a Ferrari if they have, have the opportunity at some point in their career, right?
And none of us.
The thing is, none of us ever will, right? But yeah. The thing is, and I know that it's early days yet. And I mean, Carlos he's not the new guy on the block. And last year he did really good. I mean, for me, I think that Carlos was one of those guys that kind of flew under the radar last year. I don't think that he got enough credit or got as much love as he really deserved. I mean, Charles, I think, had a bit of a nothing season. I don't want to suggest by any measure that Charles Leclerc phoned it in 2021. The car was sort of kind of really, it was kind of competitive, but not really. They ended up third in the constructors because McLaren really dropped the ball in the last part of the season. They got some timely upgrades, which really worked well on the car by the time I think they got to, was it Spa and then to Russia? That really did well. But the thing is, I know that Carlos has had a bit of, well, he had a horrible weekend in Australia, and he's saying all the right things. Don't get me wrong, because he's saying he wants to be the guy. He thinks he can take it to Charles Leclerc, but even though, and it seems kind of funny to say, well, you know, he's just not getting the job done because he's had two podiums in three races this season. But the thing is, you know, to make this more, for me, I don't want to say it's a serious discussion, because it is a serious discussion, but to maybe make that argument that Carlos should be considered on the same level as Charles, is, for me, he has to close that delta with his teammate. And I honestly hope that when we get to Imola, because it's not Monza, but it's still in Italy, it's San Marino, it's all geographically in the right place. And if he's not going to be fired up from that, especially at that horrible, horrible weekend, then I don't know what will motivate him, because he's clearly not happy with the way that things have gone thus far, despite the results. And I think that he's really, really going to be fired up. So I'm really going to be watching Carlos Sainz at Imola next weekend, because I really think this could be a statement weekend, a statement race for him. And I hope he pulls it off. I really do.
I feel bad that it seems like, or we were perceived to be coming across as really negative. In fact, maybe we just were coming across as negative, but I think for me, yeah. I have such high expectations for this team. And anytime your teammate goes in and dominates the weekend and takes pole and cruises to an incredibly easy victory despite multiple safety cars, I'm going to be very, 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 very critical of you. And the fact that you put your car in the gravel and you beached it, that's on you, mister. I get there were some circumstances around qualifying, but the bad start going into the gravel, ending your race in the first or second lap, that's on you, and you need to do better. And I think I'm frustrated because I have such incredibly high expectations for him, because I know what he's capable. Yep. And we all know what that car is capable of. So two more questions and then we can wrap it up, you think?
Sure, why not? We can do a couple more.
Okay, so here's
it's a long
one.
Weekend, my friend. I got time.
I know you do. So this one actually, this is from at Tim's Fozy, and I think we just kind of answered this question a couple of minutes ago with this with respect to Seb. If things continue this way for AMR, is Seb more likely to retire or move elsewhere? So I think we answered that. I really struggle to understand what team would want to invest in Seb at this point. He's with a team that's clearly underperforming. He's being paid a ton of money. I don't know how emotionally invested he is in that package, in that car, in that team. I don't think he's going to be back next year. And I would be shocked if there was another team willing to pay big dollars to lure him over. What about you?
Yeah, totally. I mean, let's draw a parallel here between Sebastian Vettel and at Aston Martin or Team X, should he decide he wants to move somewhere else, and compare him to what Valtteri Bottas is doing at Alfa Romeo. I think that what Valtteri has done so far this year, I think has been impressive. I know he had a DNF in Saudi. He was just one of those cars that just kind of like petered out at one moment there. But I mean, he's shown something. He's shown that, he's a very, very good driver. He's driving for a team that's in a bit, I don't even really know what to call Alfa Romeo. I mean, they're not like a super uber competitive team, so it's not like they're in a rebuilding phase, but they've certainly shown that this car has a little bit of pace. I mean, Guan Yu is showing that he's looking a little bit pacey, and he's kind of performing in the way that I would expect from a rookie Formula One driver. But you got to think that Guan Yu is probably loving the fact that he's sitting in the same garage next to Valtteri Bottas, which I think who's done a pretty good job this season. And I just at this point, I just can't see Sebastian Vettel doing a job like that at another team, say at Williams, for example. I mean, maybe he would be really excited to, but I think, if he had the opportunity to have like one kind of, kick at the can and kind of go out of the sports in a year or two in a blaze of glory, and maybe even if he doesn't win a championship, but he's there fighting for race wins, he's on the podium and kind of doing what he did at Ferrari, yeah, I could see him maybe sticking around for that. But I don't see him doing another Aston Martin type move, and I don't see him doing a move that Valtteri Bottas did to Alpha. I don't know. What do you think, Mark?
I think you did a great job of summing that up, and I don't really think I have anything else to add, but I do have another question.
Yes.
And I like this one because it's a more technical question, and it's from Ahmed Alsan. Hi, Mark and Mark. Why is there such a huge variance in tire degradation between drivers on the same compound at the same track? So I'll maybe take...
Ooh, can I answer this one?
Please.
Because reasons.
Okay.
Next question.
So I don't know that that's the quality...
I'm going to turn it over to you.
Yeah, I don't know if that's the quality response he was expecting. I think it's ultimately very, very, very challenging to put into words why one driver may experience a certain type of degradation and another driver may experience something entirely different. Ultimately, there's some principal factors that absolutely do impact the degradation and the longevity of a tire. We're talking about things like the aggregate on the track, but that would typically affect all of the drivers equally. The driving or the racing line that drivers take could introduce some variability. So if you're taking a common racing line and maybe the aggregate's a little bit smoother, maybe you get slightly less degradation. Or if you're taking a less conventional racing line and the aggregate's a little bit rougher, that could ultimately introduce some additional degradation to your tires. But then also from a driver perspective, it's all about how the car is set up. Is it a high force or high downforce setup, a low downforce setup? It could be that your downforce setup isn't necessarily balanced, which is impacting the rear more than the front because you're getting incremental downforce at the back that's not being offset with downforce at the front. That's introducing additional weight and wear on those rear tires. And it could also be something as simple as how the driver performs from a braking perspective. Where are they choosing their braking points? How hard are they letting the brakes get? And it could also be the braking setup itself. So I think the challenge is there's countless different reasons why one driver or one team might be experiencing a different level or a different rapidity of tire degradation, I think we would probably want to get into a specific example of a driver and then want to probably tap them to try to understand what they're doing or what they're seeing. But absolutely, we've seen it this year where certain drivers are seeing significantly more durability from the same compound of tire at the same track. And again, like I said, it could be the way the car is set up from a suspension perspective. It could be the camber. You know, how did they set up the camber? Negative, inverted, et cetera. Could be how the wing was set up. There's countless different factors. The one thing I would say that a lot of these teams are still trying to find that perfect balance of aero and downforce. And I think some of the degradation that we're seeing now will probably be gone within a couple of Grand Prix as the teams get more familiar with the setup of these cars.
Well, another good thing that's this one's made or meant a little bit tongue planted firmly in cheek from Evolution Consulting in the live chat, who says, don't forget the inverse proportionate ratio of tire life to driver anger, which I think is a very, very good point. You know, if you get a little bit angry and impatient, you're going to burn a little bit more rubber on the track. But, you know, it is interesting because there is no easy answer to it, because as you so nicely put it, Mark, there are so many different factors that go into it, just from driver style to, you know, the makeup and the act, like the physical qualities of the track to the way that the car's set up. It really is it's such a technical, and it's a cool discussion to have. You know, otherwise we wouldn't be talking about it, because occasionally our minds get blown by the way that certain drivers are able to extend the tire life beyond what the
operating window is. Yeah.
You know, not by a lap or two, by many, many, many laps, and the tires are still in that sweet spot. They're still at like a perfect temperature. They're not degrading, and they're still performing in a range that, you know, even impresses the driver. And I think that's what's really, really cool. And that kind of goes back a little bit to the discussion that we were having earlier about, you know, like the tire warmers and things like that, right? It's just like when it's cool to talk about those things, because that's somebody, you know. And not just, I don't want to give like all the love to the guy in the car, because there's all those people back in the pits, you know, all the mechanics and the engineers that they worked as a team to get the feedback from the driver in the car, and then the mechanics, and, you know, taking all this feedback and all this data that they're getting both from the driver and from the telemetry and setting the car up accordingly. And then they can do amazing things from that. And I think that's just one element, although a very nerdy and a very niche kind of rabbit hole of Formula One, but I think it's really cool.
Two more questions. This one we don't even need to touch because we actually did it earlier, but from @TimLudwickPhoto, let's talk about the turtle, #safety car. Tim, we've already been there. I hope we covered that. And then I think the last one tonight is going to be from @JMON26, Joe. And this is in reference clearly to Alex Albon and his 57-lap marathon last weekend. Why penalize a driver that can go the whole race without pitting? Should that rule change? And the rule that Joe is referring to is that every driver has to drive on two separate compounds in the course of a race. So they can start on a medium, finish on a hard, start on a soft, finish on a hard, but they have to race on two different compounds during the course of a Grand Prix. His question is it fair? Is it not fair? Ultimately, the rule was instituted to inject some artificial competition, strategy, and drama into the race. We've talked about this before. The compounds that these drivers are using are artificially cliffed, meaning that they're engineered in such a way that the performance will drop off a cliff after a certain number of laps, because they want to inject Pirelli, Liberty, the FIA, they want to inject some competitive spirit into the sport. And if they said to Pirelli, hey, can you engineer us a medium compound tire that'll last 58 laps, they could probably do that. But what they're doing is designing tires that are specifically designed to drop off a cliff after a certain number of laps. And injecting that two compound rule into the sport is all about forcing teams to have a pit stop, because pit stops are entertaining, there's strategy, and there's drama. And I promise you, if they did away with that stop, a lot of drivers probably would just rock a single compound the entire race, provided Pirelli could engineer it. And then the sport's suddenly a lot less exciting. Your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. You know, I think it's kind of cool when they can do that, when they can go an entire race. But even though it's a little bit of artificial kind of like racing, it does make them think a little bit. So I don't have an issue with the way that the rules are set up? I guess we've kind of moved away from the terminology prime and option tires. We don't really use that.
I like the rule. And if I came across as implying or inferring that I don't, I like the rule and I love seeing a pit stop. I don't want to see a driver rock a hard tire for 58 laps and just be like clinging on for dear life at the end. Although that could be interesting as well. I like the pit stop.
Yeah, you know, if they have to have pit stops in Formula One, I would rather see it for tires rather than fuel because, you know, number one, it kind of goes against like the whole sustainability thing. And, you know, they've got these great engines that, you know, they're difficult. You know, you could refuel it, I think, easily in a pit stop anyways. But there's also the inherent safety issue. I mean, think about, was it Johnny Herbert? Think about Jos Verstappen back in the 90s that had fuel drip, you know, after a pit stop and then ignite on an extremely warm exhaust manifold or brake disc or something like that. So there's a safety issue. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, if we're going to have pit stops, I'm totally down with the tires. And plus, I think it's kind of cool to have multiple tire compounds in a race because each tire compound works or doesn't work with each tire, car, or driver. So there's that extra level of thinking that goes into it that we've got a race that's going to last for, say, 60 laps. We think we can go this far on the softs, and then we can go this far on the mediums or the hards and the mediums or whatever it is. So I think it's kind of cool. And, you know, and watching the races at home, it's kind of fun to kind of think along and watch in real time and kind of, you know, watch their lap times too, and just watch them out on the track against the other cars they're racing against and see, yeah, well, his tires are dropping. I mean, look at Fernando last weekend. His tires really went off in the end. You know, he was looking really racy at one point. He pushed his tires too much. And then at that point, he was just dropping backwards through the field. So I think it's kind of cool. I like it.
Let's turn off the lights. So let's turn off the lights, my friend. I think this was a great show.
I think so too. Let's turn off the lights. Let's go hide some Easter eggs and enjoy the long weekend. So everyone, you know, who's in the live chat watching on YouTube tonight, thank you guys so much for coming out. Glad to see Michelle in because I know she's been looking forward to joining us for some time, but we usually do it much later than this. Anyways, guys, if you want to get in touch, easiest way is the way that we just did, and that was on Twitter at Scuderia F1 Pod. You can also send us an email at scuderiaf1pod@gmail.com. And that's it. On behalf of myself and Mr. Mark Hamilton, have a great weekend and look out for Mark's interview with Tyler Santarussa dropping in your feed for the commute back to work on Monday. That's it. Happy Easter. Have a great weekend, guys. Talk to you soon. Bye for now.